What do you do when your father dies before you turn three, leaving your mother to raise four boys alone during the Great Depression? Most people would crumble under such weight, but Melvin Kaminsky, later known as Mel Brooks, discovered something remarkable. Humor could be both armor and weapon against life's cruelest blows. His mother, Kitty, would borrow that final penny from neighbors so her youngest son could escape into movie theaters for a dime, where he'd spend entire days watching features, serials, and cartoons with a salmon sandwich wrapped in wax paper. Those dark theaters became his university, teaching him that stories could transport you beyond homework and hunger, beyond clotheslines and cats in the air shaft. What's extraordinary isn't just that Brooks survived poverty, it's that he transformed those lean years into comedy gold, proving that sometimes the funniest people are those who've stared hardship in the face and decided to laugh instead. The Borscht Belt was a crucible where young comedians either found their voice or vanished. Brooks started as a teenage busboy at Butler Lodge, but his education came from watching established comics and building his own act. His breakthrough arrived when an actor's injury forced him into a dramatic role. After spilling water and breaking the glass on stage, he removed his makeup, confessed, "I'm only 14," and got an enormous laugh. That moment taught him authenticity beats perfection. Soon, he became a pool tumbler, entertaining guests by wearing a derby and alpaca coat, carrying rock-laden suitcases to the diving board, yelling, "Business is no good, I don't want to live," and jumping in. The mountains taught him that failure isn't the opposite of success, it's the foundation. As he'd later tell aspiring artists, failure stays with you like corned beef hash, while success burns quickly like sugar. World War II sent Brooks to Europe, where he cleared mines and entertained troops with special services. These experiences revealed comedy's true purpose, essential medicine during darkness. After the war, writing for Sid Caesar's Your Show of Shows became transformative yet grueling. The thrill of audience laughter clashed with 3 a.m. writing sessions that left him chronically late and sick with anxiety. Still, those pressure cooker years forged the discipline greatness demanded. The writer's room produced legendary sketches, including their This Is Your Life parody, where Sid improvised brilliantly, swatting Carl Reiner with his raincoat. The real breakthrough came during lunch breaks, when Carl interviewed Brooks with a wire recorder, creating The 2,000-Year-Old Man, a feisty survivor riffing on everything from Shakespeare's lost play, Queen Alexandra and Murray, to cave anthems. This character wasn't just funny. It was cultural preservation disguised as comedy, keeping alive the Yiddish dialect of Brooks' grandparents and the voice of Eastern European immigrant Jews struggling in America. By the mid-1960s, Brooks pitched a wild idea. Two producers deliberately create the worst Broadway show possible, a musical celebrating Hitler, to scam investors. Most thought he'd lost his mind. Zero Mostel became Max Bialystock, a living crescendo of flesh and noise, while Gene Wilder played Leo Bloom, a walking anxiety attack. The genius was making the offensive hilarious. Springtime for Hitler worked because its absurd, over-the-top nature exposed fascism's ridiculousness. When producer Joseph E. Levine threatened to shut down production over the climactic swastika formation, Brooks simply lied, saying, "It's out," while keeping it in. The film bombed initially with scathing reviews, but Peter Sellers saw it accidentally, fell in love, and paid for a full-page variety ad calling it true genius. Brooks won the Oscar for Best Original Screenplay, beating 2001 A Space Odyssey. That statuette ended up atop his mother's TV in Florida, where she proudly displayed it during Friday afternoon tea, proof the poor kid from Brooklyn had made it. Blazing Saddles sent a black sheriff to a racist Western town, creating something so audacious, Brooks warned, "We will all be in jail for making this movie." Warner Bros. Demanded cuts. The farting scene, Mongo punching a horse, racial language, Madeline Kahn's I'm Tired number. Brooks took notes, then crumpled and tossed them. When box office receipts arrived, complaints vanished. The film shattered the fourth wall, revealing Warner Bros. Studio lots and ending at Grauman's Chinese Theater, where characters watch their own movie. Meanwhile, Gene Wilder had been scribbling about Baron Frankenstein's uptight grandson who denies his legacy of reanimating the dead. Brooks and Wilder wrote Young Frankenstein together, insisting on black and white to honor James Whale's 1930s classics. They assembled Cloris Leachman as Frau Blücher, Q whinnying horses, Madeleine Kahn as the snooty socialite, Terry Garr with her unique German accent. Brooks hated the puttin' on the Ritz scene, thinking it too silly, but Wilder insisted. Brooks admits he's never been so wrong. That scene elevated the film beyond satire into something uniquely theirs. Both films proved comedy could tackle serious subjects while remaining smart and accessible. After Young Frankenstein, Brooks launched Brooks Films to produce serious dramas, The Elephant Man, Francis, The Fly, without his name attached. These films shared his empathy for outsiders while giving directors like David Lynch creative freedom, proving his instincts extended beyond comedy. His greatest second act came when David Geffen convinced him the producers could work on Broadway. Partnering with writer Tom Meehan and choreographer Susan Stroman, Brooks transformed his screenplay into a musical spectacular. Nathan Lane and Matthew Broderick recreated the Mostel Wilder chemistry for a new generation. Opening April 19, 2001, the show earned 15 Tony nominations and won a record-breaking 12, a record that still stands. Brooks became the eighth person to achieve EGOT status, but more valuable than awards were the nightly standing ovations. The kid who borrowed pennies for movies had created Broadway's biggest phenomenon, proving there absolutely are second acts, and sometimes they're even better than the first. At nearly a century old, Brooks remains a testament to comedy's enduring power. His marriage to Anne Bancroft until her death in 2005 provided both personal joy and creative partnership. She believed in him when he was broke and inspired everything he attempted. Brooks continues performing, touring theaters to screen Blazing Saddles and share stories. When audiences ask his secret to longevity, he replies, "Don't die." But the real secret is deeper. Brooks understood that comedy isn't escapism, it's survival. Growing up poor in Depression-era Brooklyn, losing his father at two, facing anti-Semitism and war, these experiences became his material. He learned you can either let life's tragedies destroy you or transform them into something that makes others laugh. That's alchemy. In a world that feels heavy and dark, Brooks reminds us that laughter isn't trivial. It's essential. It's medicine, rebellion, and connection. His legacy isn't just films or awards, but the permission he gives us to find humor in hardship, to challenge taboos, to ring the bell loudly. So go forth and laugh, take risks, fail spectacularly. The greatest comedy comes from having the courage to be audaciously, unapologetically yourself.